very fortunate to have with us Mike Allen of the Politico, who has reported. I'm going to start him right out asking him about all of the different news organizations he's worked for, because he represents a person who has worked in a lot of different media and is in a great position to compare them and talk to us about the current campaign and the media and what kind of information is being developed on the internet, and how reporters are working in this environment, and how candidates are working in it as well. So, welcome, Mike.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a great honor and treat to be here, especially with Professor Kumar, who's incredibly respected around the White House as an institutional memory of what presidents do and what they ought to do. As you know, she keeps records and has insights that no one else has, because she watches White House communications almost as if it's a sociology experiment.
Yeah,
you say?
Like an anthropologist.
Sometimes it maybe seems a little more like zoology, I suppose, but it certainly is fun. I apologize for being the pokey puppy. I'm very sorry and embarrassed to keep you waiting. I've been covering the White House end of the Pope's visit. I wanted to show y'all something. Where's the camera? Where do I hold something up? I don't know. You guys probably can't see this. You'll see this in the paper, but I want you to be on the lookout for this. That now even the Pope has a logo. When you go to pick up your press credentials, you're given a little schedule, just like the schedules we get on White House trips, media guide. And at the top, there's this logo, and they have a slogan. Christ our hope is the Pope's slogan. And there's a little photo up here with his upstretched arms and the dome of St. Peter's Basilica behind him. And it's a little off our topic, but the White House is preparing for a very, very, very unusual event tomorrow. Only three popes have set foot on U.S. soil. John Paul came here a bunch of times. But the arrival ceremony on the South Lawn for His Holiness tomorrow is going to have 9,000 people, the most that they've ever had for an arrival ceremony in this presidency. The previous record was 7,000 for the Queen. To try and make him feel at home, the papal flag is yellow and white. They've put yellow daffodils in. Tomorrow night at a state dinner, they're serving specialties from his native Bavaria, Germany. But this state dinner is unlike any other. He's not coming to his own state dinner. He's the Pope. He can do what he wants. Tomorrow's his 81st birthday, and usually when a head of state is here, there's a very elaborate ceremonies for them, so for the state dinner. But he's not coming. They're having a state dinner for 200. He's going to be at the Vatican residence here. Apparently, it's Vatican protocol that when he's overseas, he doesn't dine with the head of state. But it certainly is unusual. And I'm thinking about all the 200 lucky people that got invitations to a state dinner in honor of His Holiness, and they probably thought they were going to see him, but they're not.
That did seem odd. I wondered why. Why he didn't come.
Yeah.
So it's a protocol that he follows everywhere.
Apparently, yeah. At least that's the excuse. Now, I was watching some. Any of y'all watch the coverage of his plane landing at Andrews a few hours ago? I see some of you did. I was watching a little bit the ABC News coverage, and ABC pointed out that it's a little unusual that he didn't invite the president to his birthday dinner that he's having at the Vatican. Like, protocol doesn't explain that. As you guys know, the Vatican was very opposed to the Iraq war, so I suppose that's a subject that probably won't come up tomorrow.
Well, would it? Because they are going to, they're going to have an Oval Office meeting.
Yeah, 45 minutes.
And wouldn't that be one of the items that he would bring up?
I guess it will, but probably, totally guessing here, probably in pretty general terms, right? Like these diplomatic things, it's like when you're, like, having a relationship with a boyfriend or girlfriend, having a, like, tense conversation, you sort of stick to pleasantries or maybe the parents of someone you're going out with. That's what these diplomatic conversations are like. When the president goes overseas and talks to these foreign leaders, they don't usually talk about any of the really the tough issues. I think you'll agree with me that that's usually done by lower-level people who sort of work things out, and so that the, when the big guys or the big guy and the big woman get together, they can more have the niceties.
So that will be their meeting tomorrow.
Yeah. And excuse me, if I would just say one more thing. I apologize for being obsessed with the Pope. I don't know if you guys are interested in it. I find it fascinating. It's, and it's the biggest thing going on at the White House this week. The other thing that's interesting, Cokie Roberts from ABC, her mother, Lindy Box, is that right?
Yeah.
Was the U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, is her connection. Anyway, she rode in the limo with President Bush, and Mrs. Bush and Jenna showed up for the arrival, and was chatting with the president about what he was going to say, and she said that he's going to discuss immigration, that he's going to talk about how he regrets that the Congress didn't pass his immigration policy, which you guys know was more sort of immigrant-friendly, included both like tougher measures at the borders and a way for people who are already here to become legal, whereas most of the Republican candidates have been pushing more of the security-only measures. So that's maybe something they can talk about that they can agree on.
Yeah, that's true. And Ed McCain, too, had been...
That's right. Yeah, that, ironically, the person who'd been very much on the president's page on this, who'd had a more compassionate immigration policy, was the candidate who eventually became the nominee, whereas these other candidates were talking about fences and moats and goodness knows what else, because they thought that that's what you needed to do to get the Republican nomination.
Yeah. Can you tell us about your background, how you got into reporting, you know, going from your education through then getting your various jobs in, in news organizations?
It would be nice to ask about that. And the way I went through my journalism jobs was quite traditional. I'd be interested, how many of you all are thinking you might want to work in some type of journalism? Many of you, or
they're political. Yeah, was one political scientist.
Yeah, and how many of you want to work in politics of some sort? Most of you. Okay. Yeah, in journalism, you work up a lot the way you do in politics. In politics, you tend to maybe work on a city council campaign, and then you work on a congressional campaign, and then you maybe work on a statewide campaign, and then you maybe work on a presidential campaign. Journalism is sort of the same way. I worked at a very small paper. The paper in Fredericksburg, Virginia, where I covered a couple of rural counties. And then I moved to the, that's about an hour outside D.C. I grew up in the O.C., Orange County, California. And I came out here to school, went to school at Washington Lee University in Virginia, got a job around there. Then I moved up to the state capitol paper, the Richmond Times-Dispatch, where I did some politics. Then I worked for the Washington Post in Virginia. Then I worked for the New York Times, where I covered Rudy a little bit and Connecticut, which was great fun because Connecticut is largely full of rich people, which is what's the New York Times readers. So you could always write stories about the wacky rich, and the New York Times would always love it. And then I came back here to the Washington Post to cover President Bush when he started. He and I started our jobs the same day. I started the day he was inaugurated. And that's how I got to know Professor Kumar, and we've had a lot of good time.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot from her about a sort of more sophisticated way to look at how the White House communicates, because no one understands that with the sort of like depth that she does.
I guess nobody's cared to look at for administration after administration and see the continuities. In all the different places that that you've reported, is there a sameness, the same kinds of elements, a continuity to the stories? Do you look to the same sorts of things in a story? What are the elements of what you're looking for in a story? If you're covering Giuliani, is that somewhat like covering a president? Because it's an executive. Are there certain kinds of things you look for in an executive?
No, I think that's a great point, that there are great similarities, and whether you're covering the mayor or congressman or a university president, or a student body president, there's sort of two halves to the job. One half is what's in front of your face. That is, what they say, what piece of paper they put in your hand, what they do at meeting, where they're going, etc. The other half of the job is what you can't see, and sometimes what they don't want you to know. So that is why they do things, what they're going to do next that they haven't told you about, what they thought about doing that they decided not to, who they're talking to, what the fights are. And so the parts of the job are equally important, because if you're covering a student body president or a mayor or a president, like, it's your responsibility to chronicle for your readers, mm-hmm. whether those readers are in paper or on the internet or broadcast consumers, to chronicle what they're doing, both to hold them accountable so you can keep track of what they're promising, and so people who can't come to the meetings or can't have an interview with them will know what's going on. But also, you're in a privileged position, and from the point of view of those of you who want to work in politics, maybe a dangerous position, where you have the opportunity to sort of pull back the curtain a little bit and talk about some of the other things that are going on. A good example of this is tomorrow in the Rose Garden. The president is going to give a speech about global warming. He's going to talk about the importance of action on that. And this is something that he probably should have done years ago, but little bits of it have dribbled out over the years. In the Washington Times yesterday, I think, did a little story about how it was coming. And so a lot of times reporting is just getting wind of things, whether you find out about it from maybe the Energy Department down the street or someone on Capitol Hill that they've talked to. Senator McCain gave a big economic speech today, and yesterday they briefed members of Congress on it. So if you snooped around a little bit on Capitol Hill, you would have found out a little bit about the speech. So that's a little bit about how you go about the job. The elements you look for are, if I was sitting at home, what would I want to know about my mayor? Or what would I want to know about my president? Or what should I know about them? And so that's a combination of, like, both things that are important to know. That is, what are they saying? What are they planning to do? And also just things that are interesting to know. For instance, today, the White House, it turned out that the First Lady, Laura Bush, is going to host an hour of the Today Show next week. The 9 o'clock hour, I think, on Tuesday, she and Ann Curry are going to be co-anchors. And that's just kind of interesting to people. Now, here's a part of pulling back the curtain. They just announced that she was going to be on the Today Show, but it turns out that that's also the day that she has a book coming out. So like a lot of people on the Today Show, she has a good reason for being there. She's not just doing it out of the goodness of her heart, as my mother would say.
Uh-huh. How do you establish relationships with people who are going to be useful? Say, for example, when you came into the White House beat, how did you do that? Because you were new to Washington, right? Because you came from New York, and you had been in Richmond before. So how do you establish the relationships that you need?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the most important things to do are to be curious and to be friendly. People who work in politics are humans, and they respond to the same things that you or I would if we're making friends in a class or on a team or whatever. Because we're covering what they do every day, we have sort of natural, similar interests. Yeah. And so you can talk about work, so to speak. But also, it's important that they come to trust you over time. So maybe they can, like, maybe tell you, give you an idea of what's coming, and know that you won't necessarily blab it if it's not ready to be out. If you can be trusted to sort of, like, protect them if they are just maybe talking to you as one of these senior administration officials that you read about. But perhaps most importantly, they can trust you, and this will be very important in your relations with reporters, whether you're working in a city hall or in a Senate office, that they can trust you to do a fair job, that you're going to explain what's really going on, that you're not going to write something that is maybe interesting or catchy, but isn't very accurate. And that's going to make them, you know, less likely to deal with you. I talked with a reporter today from the New York Observer, who's doing a story about how within this culture where everybody's trying to get noticed on the internet, everybody's trying to get linked to, everybody's trying to get out ahead and all the noise that's out there. He's looking at the question of whether there's more and more sort of shaky stories that get a lot of attention. And the example that he's using is, some of you guys may have seen the story last week about Katie Couric. Uh-huh. might leave the CBS Evening News
right.
before the end of her contract. And the Wall Street Journal got a lot of attention for doing a story about that, but it turns out that most of the facts in that story had already been out there. So they just sort of like put together old facts in sort of a splashy way, and they mentioned a meeting that had been held, and it seemed like it was recent, but it turned out the meeting was like a year ago. So he's using that as an example to look at whether at a time when everyone's, where there's so much media out there, that cheap or sensational stories are easier to get in the paper, easier to get online. And I point out to him that there definitely is that temptation or that danger. But the other way to look at it is that there's also, in a way, an even higher bar for stories. And that is because of the web, because of all the channels we have, that there's so much din and clutter and noise out there that to rise above that, you need really solid stories. So at Politico, our philosophy is that people need stories that are truly revelatory, interesting, insightful, durable, that's how you get people to click on you. Whereas if they know that they're going to get just more fluff, there's plenty of places they can get fluff. So we feel like the best way to succeed is to do sort of like more meaty, factual things that knowledgeable people will come to and will actually learn something.
Is that difficult to do in an environment where there's such speed?
Yeah. And that's a real problem, because speed is more important than ever now that if I can get a story out faster than CBS or the Washington Post, bloggers will link to me, other people will link to me, we'll get more traffic. If we get more traffic, we can sell more ads or sell our ads for more money. So there's a lot of incentive to be first, but what I often tell our younger reporters, I mean, it's worse to be first if you're not right, because a lot more people will remember if you post something that's either partly long or completely wrong. People will remember that a lot longer than they'll remember like who got the link or who was first or second. And people, we're a relatively new organization. We just started January a year ago, and so we're still, people are getting to know us. And people need to be able to trust us. And if people think that on our site things may be speedy, but you're not really sure if they're right, if I read it, I better go check it over at the New York Times, people won't bother to come to your site. So, like, as we try and build our brand and our reputation, like, we need to be both fast and right. So it's a lot of it has to do with, like, quick thinking, like trying to think ahead, anticipate what's going to happen. For instance, last night, Hillary Clinton put up an ad in Pennsylvania. Some of you guys may have seen this, taking off on those comments that Senator Obama had made in San Francisco that have been questioned. And she put what they call a man on the street ad, where they have people that just like look like ordinary Pennsylvanians. On the script, they were labeled man one, man two, woman one, woman two. And saying that they were offended by what Senator Obama had said. So that's one of the tougher ads of this cycle. Major Garrett from Fox News said it was the toughest ad that there's been, and we wanted to get that story up. They gave us the ad, but said that we couldn't put it up till 6:30 because they wanted it to break on the network news. So we just got it. We got a story ready, got the headline ready and all that, but just didn't make the link live until 6:30. So like that was a way to both be careful about it, but also to have speed on our side.
Are you able to get a hold of the people that they used?
That's a great question. We didn't try. We should have. I don't know if somebody has. But what's interesting about that is that, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'll look in the Pennsylvania papers and see what they did along those lines.
Right.
But what's interesting about that is that you always have the chance to find out something they didn't intend for you to know. For instance, some of you may have seen that Obama girl actually supports Hillary, right? Or
she didn't... She didn't vote.
Right. And she wasn't for Obama. I remember that. So sometimes, like, if you track the people down, you find out something they don't know. But even if we track these people down and they said that they loved Senator Clinton and they were offended by Senator Obama's remarks, that's going to create more coverage for Senator Clinton. So this kind of ad was very smart, because I'm guessing that if I'm a Pennsylvania newspaper or Pennsylvania TV, that they even helped me get in touch with those people. Partly because if they didn't, I might write a story saying, you know, are these people real? What's up with these people? But also, by putting the newspapers or reporters in touch with them, they'll get a story on the evening news, a story in the paper with Senator Clinton's message that they might not have gotten. So, like, that's another reason. It's probably one of the reasons that they went with that style of ad.
Uh-huh. If it turned out that the ads were made in New York and those were New Yorkers, then Obama could say that she was outsourcing.
No, that's a great term, and that's absolutely true. And it'd be interesting to find out, because they did not say where these people live, and they didn't give their names, but they didn't have Brooklyn accents, I will tell you that.
Well, your paper, because it's a paper as well as a web.
Where's the camera?
Yeah.
Where is the camera? Where?
The camera's up there.
Okay.
Is the camera there, Mike? Yeah.
Okay.
Because he moves it, he can move it around a little.
Okay.
When you started, what you had is the reputations of all of you, because you had you brought together a group of very well-known people from the Washington Post, and then did Gene come in initially, or did
a little later? Gene Cummings from the Wall Street Journal. Yeah,
and then you, John Harris, and you were at Time.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes,
yeah.
Ma'am.
And then at the time, and then John Harris and Jim Van Dyke.
Van Dyke, yeah.
And you all have you all in this news cycle have or the cycle of the election have broken a lot of stories, even if you were doing them in a slow fashion. Mm-hmm. You know, making sure that you had things like the story that that you did. That talked about Hillary Clinton having a 5% chance of winning the nomination. That that story was used for several days by other news organizations. Did it come out on a Saturday? My recollection is it came out on a Saturday.
That could be, yeah.
And then the next day, it was a major point in all the Sunday programs. Do you consider when you're going to release a story like that? Are you thinking in terms of driving other stories? Or?
Yeah, definitely. No, that's a very insightful question. That didn't happen with that particular story, but that story does illustrate something that I think will interest your students, and that is the theory behind Politico is that it used to be that people would go to WashingtonPost.com and get all their news, or go to NewYorkTimes.com and get all their news. Our theory now, and as we get into discussion, I'd be interested in your view of this and whether you agree with this, but our theory is that now people treat the web more like a buffet, and they'll get a stock quote from CNBC.com, and they'll get a forecast from weather.com, and they'll get some gossip from people.com, and our theory is that if we have interesting, important stories, that people will make Politico one stop as they go on the around the web. It's never going to be where they get everything because we don't have sports scores, but the idea is to be one stop for them. And another part of our theory is that a lot of what you read in the paper is very hazy or fuzzy, and you sort of are trying to read between the lines and figure out what the reporters really mean. And whereas if you were to run into that reporter at a bar or a Little League game or whatever, like they would tell you what's going on. And our theory is you shouldn't have to run into a reporter in the bar to know what's really going on, that we should be able to say things plainly. And so that's what we did with this story about Senator Clinton that Professor Kumar mentioned, and that is that if you talk to people in both campaigns, they feel like it's almost a mathematical impossibility at this point for Senator Clinton to win the nomination. And the story said that it was hard, or it was an uphill battle, or her narrows options were narrowing, or they said all these things to sort of like elide that core point. And so we did a story just spelling that out very plainly, and that story got a lot of attention, and it was mentioned a lot of places. We didn't put it out at a specific time because of that, but sometimes you do want to get a story out Friday afternoon so that it'll be talked about on the Sunday shows or something like that. That definitely is something, and newspapers do that too. For instance, some of the national newspapers, they have a big scoop they might put it in the Saturday paper, and the Saturday paper is the thinnest one. It probably has the least circulation, but that gives it time for it to become part of the conversation ahead of the Sunday shows. So their theory is that they might be more likely to get their story mentioned on the Sunday show if it's in the Saturday paper than Sunday morning when the shows already sort of have things in their mind. So news organizations do think that way.
Uh-huh. Well, now, White Houses have traditionally dumped bad news on a Friday afternoon for a Saturday paper because it's its mm-hmm. least circulation. Mm-hmm. Is that a mistake?
No, I don't think it is, because normal people who are shopping for groceries or taking their kids to a soccer game or whatever are maybe less likely to absorb breaking news over the weekend. Politico is owned by Allbritton Communications, which owns local ABC stations around the country. So we're headquartered here in D.C. at WJLA, the ABC station here. And ratings for their newscasts are much lower on the weekends. Viewership is less consistent because people might be going out or the news is less of a habit than it is during the week. So if you dump out bad news on Friday night, it does get less attention. I've found that's definitely a strategy that this White House uses a lot. I think it's been fairly effective for them. I mean, you know more about it than I do. Like, do you think it works, or do you think it's sort of a myth, or what's your view of it?
No, I think it does work.
Okay.
And so the story's out there, and I think if it's just a smallish kind of story, like the guy who plagiarized.
Jason Blair?
The White House official.
Yeah, that's right.
Who was doing the news columns and in the Indiana newspaper. I think actually they found him on a Thursday, and he went Thursday afternoon.
Yeah.
But that was kind of a minor item. The Clinton's administration used Friday afternoons a lot.
The Clintons had another theory that was kind of interesting, that if there was, in the various investigations that went on with them, if there were a couple pieces of paper that didn't look very good for them, they would do what they called a document dump. And they'd put out 2,000 pieces of paper, and because they figured that there was less chance that the reporters would right away find and focus on whatever the damaging material was. So the theory of, like, drowning reporters in information is something that public officials use sometimes, that the real data point, the most important or interesting thing, will be buried inside the news. A related thing is for departments like the Labor Department, Education Department, like sometimes one of the easiest ways to bury something is to just put it on the web and don't tell anybody about it. I bet there are all kinds of very interesting, very newsworthy reports posted on government websites, but just nobody knows to look for them. Nobody knows they're there. And if somebody later said that they were covering it up, they'd say, what are you talking about? We put it on the World Wide Web. But if you don't tell someone it's there, what's the point in looking for it? Now, something very unusual and interesting happened a few weeks ago. The Pentagon was releasing a report that I think it was the latest report that showed that Saddam Hussein did not have links to al-Qaeda, I think was what it showed. And or may have had to do with WMD, but it was one of those reports that called into question the rationale for the Iraq War. Jonathan Carl from ABC heard about it, popped up a story on abcnews.com. The administration knew that they were going to get some bad publicity for this. So instead of putting this report out at the Pentagon, where the Pentagon reporters were the ones that would write about it, or instead of posting it on the web, they told the reporters that they would mail it to them. And if you wanted this report, you had to call a Navy base in Norfolk, Virginia, give them their information, and they would mail you a disk. So that's another sort of modern way using old-fashioned techniques to bury the news.
Uh-huh. And did it work?
I think it did. I think there were many fewer stories about the people still wrote about it, but they said much less about it. I think it probably did work.
Uh-huh. How do you measure the success of Politico? When you all began, as an organization? Were there set goals and then ways of measuring it?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, we're very focused on metrics and measuring success. There are several ways to measure success. We're fortunate that we're doing well. We've been blessed to have this like incredibly exciting campaign that's led to a lot of hunger for news about it. But the different ways that you measure success are in advertising, where we've been lucky. We've been doing very well. We'll always take more.
Is that advertising in the paper or advertising on the website?
Both. At this point, interesting enough, most of the revenue comes from advertising in the newspaper version, which goes out to Capitol Hill. And so a lot of the ads there are aimed at congressmen. For instance, on the back page today, there's an ad for Goldman Sachs talking about one of their philanthropy campaigns, and that would be aimed at members of Congress and their staff to build goodwill for Goldman Sachs. We also have advertising on our website, but at the moment we make a lot more money from the ones in the paper. You can also measure your success by your web traffic. We've been incredibly fortunate in that area. Our web traffic is roughly the same as the Washington Post political web traffic. So we've done very well. Our traffic doubles every few months. The challenge for us will be keeping that going in 2009 after this very exciting campaign. We have plans for that, for covering the new administration. I think whoever becomes president, I think there'll be a lot of excitement about that person that will help us keep an audience, keep building an audience. I think both the House and the Senate Democrats will enlarge their majorities, and so Congress will be able to do more stuff. Mm-hmm. Or so I think that will build interest too. And other ways that you measure success are you producing journalism that matters, that makes a difference, that people will remember, that helps people understand what's going on in the political process and with these unusual candidates? Are you getting attention? Do you have a good reputation? Do people feel like you're a reliable place to take news, a reliable place to get news? And so we've been lucky in all those areas, but we work hard every day to all of them. We're a startup. We keep a startup mentality. I always tell our young people, you know, come in today and think about it. Like, if today were your last day, like, of Politico, like, what would you do? Every day we try and think like that. What can I do today that will help this business last for another year?
Uh-huh. How many people are there, and how many are reporters?
Okay. I think that there are about 50 news people, so that would include reporters, editors, graphic designers. And I think there's about 20 business people who sell ads and market the product in various ways. And the way the staff is divided, we have, I'd say, 8 reporters cover Congress probably, and probably 8 reporters cover lobbying, and probably 10 reporters cover some aspect of the campaign. And I think there's probably maybe 5 people who work as designers, you know, putting out this paper. And I think there's probably, you know, 6 to 10 web producers who put things on the web. And then there's about 10 bosses.
So. Will you have somebody at the White House in the new administration? Are you going to cover it with somebody there?
Yeah.
At the end of the administration?
Yeah.
Will you start at the end?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. I think we'll probably start to... Right now, we don't have somebody at the White House every day. When we do White House stories like this Vatican thing, I sort of do them, but I have other responsibilities. I think we'll have full-time people at the White House starting probably covering the transition of the new president. So probably like after the new guy or woman is elected, we'll probably start to cover them after that.
Uh-huh. Have you found that one of the dynamics of news today is that there's an enormous amount of information, and what there isn't is understanding, and that what needs to be done for people, and how do you all do it, is to try to bring understanding, because there, you know, people certainly can't complain that there isn't information on
things. Oh my goodness, yes.
You know, there's just there's more information you can possibly process. How do you process it? And is that one of the things that you all have talked about as a goal of what you do?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point because, yes, there's so much stuff. And there's something to suit everyone, right? Like, a lot of times people still complain. They say, why don't you guys cover issues? I'm like, are you kidding? Like, if you want to know about healthcare, I can show you some websites, including parts of our site, that will give you everything you'd want to know about healthcare. And of course, what they're saying is they want more emphasis on it and the coverage. But, you're making the point that, like, there's so much chaff, so much noise out there. And so to try to do some journalism that matters, that will really cause people to understand the situation better, or that will make people want to come back to the site, some of the things I tell our young reporters are, one thing I tell them is, if you hadn't written this story, would you read it? And that's sort of like a base line of, like, whether or not it's worth doing a story. And it's amazing how often that's not the case. Like, if you look in, there's some stories in the A section of the newspaper, and you're like, who would read that story? Like, very few people, especially when people are so busy. So what we ask our reporters to think about are, if you were extremely informed person in this topic matter, like if you were a healthcare expert, would you learn something from this? Might someone who read this do a blog posting about it? Might someone who read this buy or sell a stock based on it? Might someone who read this decide to support or not support a candidate? Might someone who read this story email it to a friend? Might someone who read this story call a fraternity brother? So the point is, a story that, like, isn't going to just go in one ear and out the other, but a story that for some reason is going to cause people to pause and take some sort of action or get some kind of understanding. That's what's going to make people coming back to your site. And that's, if you're a reporter, that's what's going to make people remember your work.
Uh-huh. In order to prepare yourself, what do you read in terms of the hard copy, you know, newspapers you read, websites that you look at?
Mm-hmm.
How do you inform yourself? Yeah. Like during a day, what are the rhythms of your day?
Mm-hmm. My day starts about 3:30, sometimes 4. In the morning, I do something called Playbook. It's at our site. If you want to read it, it's a shortcut way to find out what's going to happen that day. That takes me usually about 3 hours. I try and get it up by about 7 in the morning, because that's when most reporters are sort of getting ready for their day. That's when people are hitting the treadmill in the gym or maybe getting on the metro. And so I can read Playbook on their Blackberries. There's a way on the site to get it emailed to you, and we have many thousands of people who get it emailed to them. And what it tries to do is find what's going to make news that day, what's going to be interesting that day. Everybody gets up and everybody reads the same papers, looking for the same few interesting stories. So what we try and do is pick out the story that's going to be interesting that day. A good example of this, the other day, the Wall Street Journal had a story about how Mark Penn, Senator Clinton's top campaign manager, had been lobbying for a trade deal with Colombia at the very time that she'd been on the campaign trail being against it. And he wound up resigning because of that, or getting different duties because of that. So we flagged that story for people, because not everyone wants to wake up and right away read the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Washington Times and USA Today and the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times and the New York Post and the New York Daily News and AP and USA Today. So I do that for them and pick out the top, you know, 10 or so stories. We give some flavor from the campaigns, what's going to be happening that day. So my day starts, like, immersed in a lot of media like that. For all of you, I would recommend reading something like that, or there's something on Slate.com called Today's Papers that gives the what's on the front page of a lot of the national papers. That's a good quick way to catch up. Do any of you guys look at the Drudge Report? Why do you do? As you guys know, like, that's a good quick way to catch up. Sometimes they have sort of sketchy thing, but mostly it's just linked to stories in very respected news organizations. And it's a great shortcut to what people are talking about. The reason that site is so popular is that he has a very good sense of what people are going to be talking about, what's going to be driving the conversation, what other reporters are going to be writing about. And sort of a lot of people in media look at it, producers, reporters, because they know other producers, reporters, politicians. It's very popular among politicians. Read it. but just because they know that everybody's sort of looking at it. So a lot of people we know, whether they work in government, whether they're Democrats, whether they're Republicans, they'll look at the Drudge Report a lot of times during the day. Some other sites that I like, I mentioned Slate, I mentioned Salon. Have any of you guys checked out a site? It's more sort of liberal, progressive, Talking Points Memo. That's a great site, some of you. That's a great site for those of you who are interested in politics. If you want the more conservative side, you might head over to the blog called The Corner at National Review. All the big networks, newspapers now have blogs devoted specifically to politics. The New York Times has The Caucus, and NBC has First Read. And so it's sort of a matter of getting used to what you feel comfortable. Like, do you like the way it looks? Do you like the tone of it? And so I encourage people to just, like, sample a lot of sources of information. Try this blog, that blog. Just click around a little bit. I don't have any, and I don't really recommend, like, any to get in any particular rut, because there's so much good stuff out there. Nobody could want to read it. Nobody would want to or could read it all anyway. And so I just graze around and try different things on different days. Uh-huh. Sometimes I'll even check out what's in the British papers, just because it gives you a different point of view. And I did some traveling in Europe last week for the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and I was very struck by how much attention there was to this election over there.
Yeah.
In Italy, which had its elections on Sunday, they announced the results yesterday. Even though they had their own elections coming up, huge attention to the U.S. races.
Uh-huh.
Both because they know it is the leader of the free world. They know that it's going to affect them, but also because this is just like such a great soap opera, right? Like, this is better than any reality show, and that's why it's great for people who are passionate about politics like yourselves, and it's fun for people who cover it like Martha and me.
Yeah, because it's the most exciting election I remember.
Is that right?
Yeah. It really is.
Yeah.
68 was exciting, but in a different kind of way, mm-hmm. and you know, that had so many depressing elements to it.
Yeah. And people genuinely don't know what happens with this. Like, usually reporters think they know what's going to happen, and they're wrong, but they think they know. And this time, reporters don't even think they know.
When you're thinking about the web and the kinds of different categories of sites, what are some of the ways that you look at it? Like, for example, there are sites that are good for fact-checking.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say, Smoking Gun or Fact Check.
Uh-huh.
There are ones that are accumulators.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. Sites you can rely on, because there's so much junk out there. Like, what can you trust, right? A very interesting site that doesn't get a lot of attention that would be handy for y'all, it's called Bartleby.com. It's Bartleby, Bartleby.com. And it has actual reference books on it. It has mm-hmm. Columbia Encyclopedia. It has one of the quotation dictionaries. So it's like, you know, you can't really trust Wikipedia. And because it pops up, people look at it. But, like, you have no way of knowing if what is there was just changed by some clown who is going to make you look stupid for using it. So, like, you can't trust it at all. It can be a guide to finding something else. Like, because it pops up first when you Google somebody, like, if I want to know Teddy Kennedy's birthday, like, almost certainly Wikipedia is what's going to pop up first, but I would never use it based on what was in Wikipedia, because I just don't know if it's right. But I would take it, and I would use that to check it somewhere else, like on his own website or whatever. Bartleby.com is a good place to check facts. Always go to, like, the most primary source you can, like, if I'm looking for a quote by the president, I'll go to whitehouse.gov as opposed to the New York Times or even Politico. Because, like, I know I make mistakes. Like, I've misquoted the president, I'm sure. So I go to the most basic source I can. And we're fortunate now. Similarly, if I'm looking for a quote for Hillary Clinton, if it's on her site, I'll take it off her site rather than some news organization site, which may have made a mistake. Now, the candidates don't put up everything they say, because they don't want you to know everything they say, but if it's a case where you can, definitely will. For instance, and all these comments that Senator Obama made that a lot of attention has gone to. As you guys know, they were originally posted on the Huffington Post. All good, like this morning, I was quoting it, but I went to the Huffington Post to get it because I just went back to the very first place I could get. By the way, very interesting stories out tonight about how that story came out. It was posted by a blogger who's for Obama and has given $2,300 to him, the most that you can give. Knew that this was interesting and put it out there, even though that it's arguably going to be damaging him. So it's kind of a story behind the story that hadn't come out, and I'm going to write about that in the morning because it's pretty interesting.
Do you think it's an example of how candidates can be just naive about what off the record is? Sessions that they think that are off the record. I mean, they're just rarely so. It used to be that people could get quoted on them, but now it's not just the quote. You have the voice, and you also have the pictures.
Yeah, that's a great point. And candidates sort of know this. And in this case, I don't think it was, as you guys know, in a closed setting. It was a fundraiser in San Francisco. The fact that it was in front of wealthy people in a very liberal area definitely hurt him. Like, I think if Senator Obama had made these same comments to Pennsylvanians, saying it to their face, saying, "I understand your frustration, I could help alleviate your frustration," I think the remarks would have been viewed very differently. They're viewed the way they were because he gave them in a private setting and people only found out about them a week later. There still is no video of them, interestingly enough. Audio is out of it. And on our site, we posted some video from right before the controversial part. And I don't know if it was taken with a cell phone or not. I'm not really sure. But we posted the only video anybody's ever seen of this event. But this makes you wonder, did the person stop filming, or is there somewhere out there video of him saying these remarks? But the way that they came out definitely influenced how it was covered.
In a way, this reminds me, it's related, but I'll then get you back on the websites. But fundraisers in the Clinton years, were a time when you got almost the best sense of who Clinton was. Because when Clinton went to fundraisers, he was telling the people who had supported him what he had done, what accomplishments they had had, how he saw issues, how he saw the future. And so if you wanted to read Clinton, almost the best place to do that was to look at fundraisers. And at the beginning, they had closed them. And then reporters raised such a ruckus that they decided to open them. And I thought in the long run, they really worked in his favor because it showed him talking about his priorities and explaining what it was that he had done. Bush has decided not to do that, Bush has closed fundraisers. And one of the weaknesses, I think, in his presidency and his communications is his lack of explanation of what it is he does. He announces things of what he does, but he really doesn't explain it. And that fundraisers would be a setting in which he is much more likely to do that. Have you ever been in any of his fundraisers?
Yeah, I don't know if I have. When they do close a lot of their fundraisers, they have an interesting policy. They close fundraisers that are in people's homes. And so if he gives a fundraiser in like a hotel, I think this is right, correct me, but I think this is right. If he does a fundraiser in like a hotel or a stadium, it's open to the press. If it's in someone's home, it's closed. But because of that policy, we think they put most of the fundraisers in people's homes. So it's a little bit of chicken and egg thing. But you're right, at these fundraisers, the people do talk much more candidly, and they do talk about, as you say, their accomplishments, what they plan to do. And that's because they're sort of like reporting to their investors or their funders. And that's why people who are big donors to a campaign can be very good sources for reporters, because a lot of times they do know what's going on because they talk to senior people in the campaign or they get a heads up about what's going to happen. And so donors can be a very fertile source for our reporters, because they often like hear things sooner or hear things that we wouldn't necessarily. But that's the point Professor Kumar made about the president not explaining what he does, sort of announcing things, is a very interesting insight. That's like a very good point, and I think that that's very true.
Yeah, and it's simply the way he is. It's his style.
Yeah, he's the, you saw that quote where he's the decider. I mean, one of the defining quotes about this president, when Bob Woodward came out with one of his books, he went on 60 Minutes and played some audio that he'd made with his little hand recorder of an interview that he did with that he'd done with the president. And one of the things the president said was, I don't need to explain things to people. Maybe people need to explain things to me. I'm the president. And like, I think that very much reflects the way he looks at the job.
Yeah, yeah. And it's definitely not helped him. Can you all now come up with some questions? We'll switch to you all. Yep.
How much freedom do you have to run the stories that you want?
Yeah, that's a good question. And by that, do you mean what kind of stories do you think might not get run, or what kind of stories were you kind of wondering about?
Well, actually, funny you mentioned that. Do you know anything about Mark Emery?
I don't.
All right. Well, he is a Canadian citizen who's never been to the United States, and he is facing extradition. And this has been going on for about 3 years now. And I always do nexus searches trying to find U.S. publications that do stories about him. I found like two. Most of the stories, he's got plenty of stuff coming out in Canada all about it.
Uh-huh.
Because the crime he did in Canada is punishable by a small fine and a month in jail, but in the United States, it's life in prison.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, I see your point. And what's interesting about that is, like, no one, like, keeps you from writing a story about that. It just, for whatever reason, hasn't been on the radar screen of American reporters. But a similar example in the political realm might have been Ron Paul, that people felt like Ron Paul didn't get as much coverage as he should have. And in fact, he was, by some measures, the most popular of the candidates. In I think the last quarter of last year, he raised more money than any of the other candidates. He had more money left at the end. And so usually there isn't anyone, there certainly isn't anyone that like prevents us from writing about a topic. We might not write about a topic if we didn't think that it was interesting or if we couldn't prove it or whatever. But if there was something that we knew was true and knew was important, we would find an interesting way to write about it. But as a reporter, your sort of job is just to convince an editor that this is something important and worth covering. So to take the Mark Emery example, and I'm going to go, look up about him because I just didn't know about him and I probably should have. If I were going to try and sell an editor a story about that, I would get some information about what's going on with the case. I would see what other people had written about it. And I would go in and I would say, to my editor, Charlie, I would say, there's this very interesting case in Canada. It's gotten a lot of attention up there. It hasn't gotten much in U.S. papers. But here's the situation, blah, blah, blah. And then he might say, well, I don't really know if people are going to be interested in that. Or you might say, wow, yeah, that sounds interesting. So that's the kind of conversation that you have when you're trying to decide like whether or not it's worth investing your time in a story, or maybe we'd want to go to Canada and talk to him or whatever.
How do you decide, say, for a day, what stories are going to pursue? What kind of story selection process do you have?
Yeah, that's a great point, because there's so many things happening every day that might make an interesting story. So we do it a couple ways. At most news organizations, one of the ways is reporters who are specialists in an area sort of make suggestions. So if I'm a congressional reporter for the New York Times, I'm going to need to know what's going on Capitol Hill. Now, my editor might well have some ideas for me. He might say, we haven't had a story about Teddy Kennedy for a long time. Or he might say, I saw something on TV last night about how Speaker Pelosi is doing X or Y. He might suggest a story to me, but but I'm supposed to know what's going on. Like, is a housing bill going to pass, or that sort of thing. And so a lot of the information comes from the reporters, like what's important that's going on. And then the editors, whether it's of the print newspaper, I mean, even if there's 8 interesting things going on today, we only have space on our front page for 5, maybe 6 things. So even if there's like more interest, and the New York Times now has, I think, 6 stories on the front page, maybe 7. And the network news has 22, whatever it is, minutes, even if there's 30 minutes of interesting stuff going on. So editors, producers, the higher level people, once they know all the things that they could write about, then they start making those choices. And in making those choices, this is the balance we're talking about. What's interesting, what's important? If it's important, can I make it interesting? If it's interesting, is there some element of it that's important? And, you know, sometimes things are news just because they're interesting. There's a story on the front page of the New York Times today. It's a classic example of this. It's about how the guy who was building the Titanic was running out of rivets. And obviously he didn't have enough, right? But he knew at the time that he didn't have enough. And it's something that recently came out in a new book. Well, that's not going to change history, or that's not going to, like, influence an election. It's just interesting. And there it was on the front page of the New York Times. So there's a mix of things like that that you consider.
Yeah. Like the Post the other day had a story, I think it was Sunday, on the front page about food, with the food prices going up at restaurants. They've been finding ways of
smaller portions,
that, like on a steak.
Yeah,
it was very funny.
Yeah, and that's something everybody can relate to, because like not everybody really cares about Goldman Sachs, but everybody eats in a restaurant. So
yeah. Another question?
Yes, sir.
The majority of the political reporters we've interviewed have the degrees in English and journalism. Do you think there's kind of an informational disconnect between they have to write about politics, social issues, economics, and like international relations, and they don't have a background in what they're discussing? Or do you think it's more important that they study journalism to like learn how to investigate and write?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I majored in politics, and I was a major in economics until I took my first stats class. And after stats, I was not an econ major anymore. But reporters don't tend to be very good with math. But it is very important to be knowledgeable in a subject area, and that can come through, as you suggest, academic training. And young people who want to go into journalism, I recommend to them that they become an authority in a subject area, whether it's law or health or business, that's the best way to stand out and the best way to get a job. That once you're an authority in the subject matter, like if you're good with people, you can learn to tell stories, or an editor can help you tell stories. And the great thing about journalism is you can just sort of jump in and do it. If I wanted to be a butcher or a airline pilot or a surgeon, I couldn't do that when I was in college. But in college, you could do the exact same kind of journalism that I do. You could go out, you can interview people, you could tell people what you find out. And somebody who has good personality people skills can always do that. But I agree with your point. It's very important to be knowledgeable in a specific subject area, and I think that is, even though like there's a lot of, you can have a lot of success with communications journalism training, at the very least you need to mix that with some knowledge on your own. That could be something you learned on your own just by reading about the law or studying health, or you could go through some sort of formal degree program.
Uh-huh. You could get it, too, from a journalism career where you move from one place to another. Say, for example, David Sanger was based in Japan and learned a lot about North Korea. And when he came to the White House, he was able to use North Korea as a thread to pull at the White House to figure out how the place is working. And so a lot of different subject areas, whether it's that or healthcare, if you know a lot about it, then when you get to the White House, you can you can use it effectively to judge how the place is working.
Yeah, now that's a really good insight. Now, the point you just made about David Sanger from the New York Times is a great point. That he wrote about a subject that really no one else was writing about at the time. And so that's another way that you can stand out, is to focus on something that everything's not. Reporters tend to all write about the same thing. You can draw the analogy of a little kid's, a four-year-old soccer game. They're all on the ball, right, instead of being like where they should be. And reporters are the same way. Reporters all write about the same topic. Everybody's writing about the Pope now that he's here. But 2 weeks ago, if you'd written a story about the White House relations with the Vatican, like, that story would have stood out, and a lot of people would have read it, and you would, and you might have found out a lot of interesting things that you wouldn't now that he's here and people are busy. So that North Korea example is a great example, that he wrote about it, so he got news that other people weren't getting. But also, as Professor Kumar said, he was able to notice some larger truths about this White House by doing that. And the same thing could happen whatever level of government or public life you were writing about.
Uh-huh. Have you found that most of the institutions you've covered, are they difficult to get news from that you want?
Yeah,
are they similar or different?
No, that's a great point that you said that you want.
They'll certainly give you like 2,000 pages.
Right, right, right. Yeah, the White House puts out a big stack of, probably a big stack of press releases every day, but most of it isn't things that I would want to write about or that you would want to read about. So whatever the institution is, whether it's a mayor's office or a university president's office, like the juiciest stuff is not stuff they're going to put in a press release, right? So the key is knowing people who can who might deal with that office or who might be willing to talk to you about it. This White House, as some of your previous speakers and as your professor have talked about, has had a policy of like not putting out a lot of information that in the Clinton administration, they would be a lot more likely to talk to you about some internal fight that they'd had or something like that. Now, with so many people leaving and writing books and giving speeches, you can find out a lot more now.
Yeah.
But for a long time, it was pretty tough pulling of teeth. And so someone who, you know, knew that extra person or, you know, took that extra time, made that extra call, could really, really stand out.
Uh-huh. Another question?
Yes, sir.
How is it different working for a relatively new publication versus an established one?
Yeah. No, thank you. That's a very good question. When you work for Time Magazine, you don't have to explain to anyone what it is. With Politico, sometimes I still have to spell it. We're fortunate that most people that we deal with know about it now, but it definitely isn't as well known as Time Magazine. And so part of that is more of a requirement for you that you do excellent work. If you work for the Washington Post, a certain number of people, certain few hundred thousand people are going to read your product no matter what. A certain number of people are always going to take the Washington Post, like a certain number of people are always going to read the White House story in the Washington Post. Whereas Politico, it has to be good, or it has to be something they don't know, or it has to be interesting. And so being new, just as if you were to start a new brand of car, there would have to be something very special about your car so that people would try it instead of something that they could count on, like a Honda or a Chevy. If you start a new restaurant, it has to be something special. It has to be hip or different so that people will get out of their dining habits. So that's part of it. Another part of it is there's less security. Like Time Magazine is going to be there in 20 years or 30 years. Like Politico, if we don't do a good job, if we don't work hard, if we don't build an audience, if we don't make money, like it's not going to be there in 20 or 30 years. So that's another part of it. It's a little like a campaign in that every day, you come into a campaign and you think, okay, we need to win today. What am I going to do today that's going to get us toward getting more votes in November than the other guy? And Politico is, or any new business, is like that too. If I open a tire store, I've got to come in every day and say, okay, how am I going to sell one more tire to keep my door open another day? Whereas if I work for Sears, like Sears is, actually is not that good an example, but if I work for Walmart, like Walmart's going to be there whether or not I sell a lot of tires today or not.
Uh-huh. Another question?
Sir, Redskin.
All right. Newspapers like to endorse candidates. Does your website?
It does not, and it's an interesting question because some people, some publications are moving away from that now in the case of presidential races, because some newspapers have the theory that people have all the information they need about a presidential race. Now, for like a judge's race or a state legislative race, you might want to know the news organization's opinion. But because we are sort of down the middle, we cover both sides, we want and need both Democrats and Republicans to trust us and rely on us. And so we do not have like editorials in a way, in the way that newspapers do. Now, publications have different sorts of policies about this. One interesting policy is at Slate.com, before a presidential election, the everyone on the paper, on the website, posts how they voted. And so you can see who voted for Kerry, who voted for Bush. Almost everybody voted for Kerry. I think we're not going to do that. Journalists have different policies about voting. I don't vote. I think that I sort of owe it to the people I cover to sort of have a clear mind and not sort of make it my mind and my heart. But a lot of journalists feel differently, which is fine. But there are very different policies about that, and they all boil down to what can you do so that people will know that what they're reading is fair? What should you do so that people will trust the information they're getting from you? And that's, people have different ways of going about it, but that's the important thing in the end.
Uh-huh. John Osborne of New Republic, who was New Republic a long time ago, did a column on Nixon Watch, and then he did it through several other, he did it through Ford and Carter. He took the same position. He didn't vote.
Interesting. And Leonard Downey, the executive editor of the Washington Post, is someone else who feels that way.
Uh-huh. There's a young woman right there that... right. Yeah.
Hi.
I was just going to ask you, just considering what you just said with all the challenges that you would face in starting up any kind of new, any publishing, anything new, what made you want, considering the current state of any, all forms like print journalism, what made you want to take on that challenge, which would be even harder considering what the state is of print journalism right now and its decline?
No, that's a very insightful question. I appreciate your asking that. You have a good like sense of the industry. It's like a very smart question. I did it exactly for that reason, that so many of the news organizations are having to do more with less. So many of them are managing decline. So many of them are figuring out how they can stay in business, even though they're smaller. Whereas we are looking for ways to grow. We're hiring people. We were 20 when we started, and we're 70 now. We're looking for things to add. We added Hollywood Politico. We're working on Wall Street Politico. We added Politico on campus. We're going to start Spanish Politico. And so it's a way to, and because the way that we're different from the Washington Post or Channel 7 or ABC is that when people's viewing or reading habits change, like they lose audiences. The more people's habits change, the better it is for us because we're out giving people information in a new way, and so the more habits change, the better it is for us. So our traffic and viewership is going like this, where other people's is shrinking. So I'm sort of a like glass, think of the glasses half full. I'm kind of a positive person, and I've enjoyed being in a place where we're looking for rooms to grow instead of like worrying about like what's going to happen next week.
Uh-huh.
But the gist of your question is very insightful. There was some risk to it, just as you know, I said Time Magazine will always be there. You don't have to worry about getting the check. Here there's more risk, but it was more exciting. And the people who started it are my close friends, so it was a way to do something with my friends. I'd never done anything entrepreneurial. I'd always just gotten a straight paycheck. So it was a way for me to personally try something new, a way to create something that hopefully would last. One of our theories is to bring along the next generation of young reporters, Jonathan Martin, Ben Smith. Our theory is if in 3 years, if we're writing the stories, we haven't done a good job. Like, what we want to do is, like, teach other people how to do what we're doing so that we can then move on.
Another question? Yeah.
Do you have to consult with the expert to get information to write a story? Do you find that they're cooperative or generally hesitant to give you the information that you want?
Yeah, that's a good question. You can get quite a mix of that. And sometimes it depends, like, whether it's in their interest to help you. So if you go to an academic expert or someone at a group, say the Kaiser Family Foundation, which gives you very neutral information about healthcare, they might be very eager to help you or being very nice to help you. A lot of Professor Kumar's academic colleagues, very generous to us. She's extremely generous. I've quoted her many times. She's been nice enough to help me with many stories. Sometimes I'll say, does this seem right? Does that seem right? What about this? She's very generous about helping me. There's nothing in that for her, but she just shares her knowledge. So a lot of times you'll get people like that. Other times you'll get an expert who is helping you because it'll either help them get their name out there so that they can sell books or get viewers or get people to read their blog, or because it'll help their cause, because they're for immigration or they're against immigration. So there's all different reasons that someone might help you. Now, you asked about, sort of topic experts, but as far as, like, people who are involved in the process, politicians, like, sometimes they'll be very helpful and chatty, mostly if it sort of makes their point. If it's going to make them or their boss look bad, they're going to be much less likely to help you. So you have to find people whose interest it is in to get the story out. So if I'm trying to figure out about some deal that the White House and the Speaker of the House made, the White House might not tell me about it, but maybe someone in the Speaker's office would if they won. So you have to just sort of like look around and sort of cast a wide net to try to find people who's either are nice enough to help you or whose interest it is to help you.
Mm-hmm. When you get something, say you go to the Hill and you get something about what's going on in the White House, and then you take it to the White House, does that open them up?
Sometimes it does, because then they'll want to give their side. They'll be like, wait, it didn't quite happen exactly that way. It happened this way. Or sometimes they'll say, yeah, you got that. Like, most Washington stories, there's most stories anywhere, it's very rare that someone comes to you and says, Mike, you know what? I have a great story for you. Here it is. President Bush is, as I mentioned, announcing a climate change policy tomorrow. Excuse me. Here's President Bush's speech. Go write a story about it. That very seldom happens. Instead, what happens is you get little puzzle pieces. Like someone at the Energy Department knows a little bit about the speech, and someone on the Hill knows a little bit about the speech, and maybe someone at the White House knows a little bit about it. And you might take those and you put them together, and then you might call a senior person at the White House, whether it's Dina Perino, the press secretary, or the chief of staff, and say, this is what I think is in the speech tomorrow. Can you help me with this? And they might say, oh, wait, that's mostly right, but no, not that. You want to say this way, or I wouldn't say that, or yeah, you're right, and also don't forget, blah, blah, blah. So they might just sort of like fill in the blanks for you or correct it. But if I'd called that person and said, what's in the president's speech tomorrow, they would have just said, we're going to let the president speak for himself. You know, how many times have you heard that? Stay tuned, right? Those different things that they say. So yeah. That's the sort of one of the ways you just sort of go about sort of like trying to build the blocks of a story.
We were talking some while back about your day, and you start off at 3 o'clock in the morning.
3:30. Don't make it worse than it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that seems pretty bad. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, I usually come into the.
Do that at home.
Usually at home, yeah. Not always, but my connection to work is faster. So sometimes going to work, like I calculate. How much time would I save if I go into the office? So sometimes I go in the office. But a lot of my work is done in D.C. and with the campaigns. I work our offices across the river from Georgetown in Northern Virginia. So a lot of my work is done in D.C., whether it's at the White House or visiting the campaigns or going out with a candidate. But if I'm in town, I'll usually go. We sort of have a 9 to the, our paper's done at 8 at night. So, but a lot of people are gone by 6 or 7. So we sort of have a sort of typical sort of news organization metabolism of it gets really busy at 10 in the morning and at 6 at night it starts to trail off. But if you're traveling with a campaign, you're sort of at their mercy and you sort of just adopt to their schedule. Like Jonathan Martin, one of our reporters, went to Pittsburgh for a speech that John McCain gave today, and he had to take a plane out at 6 in the morning. Now, sometimes these candidates will be on the road for several days at a time, and you just stay on their plane with them. In this is unusual. They don't do this anymore, but in 2000, I was covering Bill Bradley, who's running for against Al Gore, as you remember, for the Democratic nomination. And we went out on January 2nd, and we didn't come back until he lost on March 16th. In that time, he went home one time to his house in New Jersey to get clothes. But we were never off the road. So in a campaign sort of environment, you're sort of totally on their schedule. Now, one good thing about this president is he likes to sleep in his own bed. So we don't spend that much time on the road with him. Like, usually he's either at the White House or at Camp David or at his ranch in Texas. But it's very rare that we'll go out and spend a night in Milwaukee and another night in Montana and another night in California. With Clinton, I think he did that a lot. With this president, not so much.
Yeah, that's true. He doesn't like to be out, I think, more than 4 days at a time. Although this year, he's really had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But since he's doing international travel in this last year.
Yeah, it's catching up with saying goodbye to a lot of world leaders, going to his last summit, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. And getting some attention abroad.
Right.
Because he's not as as an important as news story as he was in the previous 7 years.
No, that's a great point. Very amusing example of that. Today, the London paper, The Telegraph, had a great story about how all three of the presidential candidates are having a meeting on Thursday in D.C. with the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, and explained what Clinton's going to do and what McCain's going to do and what Obama's going to do. And in like the eighth paragraph, Toby Harnden, who you know, their reporter, said, oh, and by the way, he's also meeting with President Bush. So years ago, that would have been the total news. This time, it's almost an afterthought. All the attention is going to be to the meetings that he's having with the candidates.
Yeah, that's a great story. Thank you very much, Mike.
Oh, this was
excellent.
This was a huge treat. Let me give you all my...